It's Monday, August 11th, 2008, and it's 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. And continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Hey everybody, welcome to the Daily Audio Stash and the beginning of Hemp Fest week. It's going to be quite a busy week coming up here because the Seattle Hemp Fest is this weekend. So for Thursday and Friday's shows, you might get a little bit of a light posting there on the Stash, if at all, because I'll be on the road getting there up to Seattle. I come to you with a bit of a heavy heart today. You can probably tell by the music that I'm a little upset at the death of two of my favorite performers. Of course, comedian Bernie Mac passed away at age 50 due to complications from pneumonia at a Chicago hospital.
I love what I'm doing. I never thought that I'd be doing it on this level.
And the news from last night that really broke my heart is Isaac Hayes, the great musician and composer, passed away as well. You may know Isaac Hayes from his voicing of Chef on South Park, or of course from this song, the theme from Shaft. But if that's all you know about Isaac Hayes, you need to do a little bit of Googling and pick up some of his music. I'm telling you, Isaac Hayes and a good sativa work well together. Well, coming up today on today's Daily Audio Stash, we're going to take a look at cannabis politics with the executive director of Oregon Normal, who is also a member of the Normal Board of Directors and the co-chief petitioner of the Oregon Cannabis Tax Act 2010. Madeline Martinez, my good friend, joins us, and she's here to talk about a front page business article in Portland's daily newspaper, The Oregonian. So that's quite a bit of good coverage that we need to talk about, and Madeline will be here to tell us all about it. Also, Normal's Deputy Director Paul Armentano joins us to give us the latest updates on the case of Rachel Hoffman down there in Tallahassee, Florida. You'll remember Rachel was the marijuana consumer who was brought into a drug You'll remember that Rachel was that young woman in Florida who got involved with that drug sting gone bad. The Tallahassee Police Department has been found negligent in her death by a grand jury, and there's many more updates we need to get to, so we'll cover those with Paul here in just a moment. Also, we've got a stupid stoner story and your regular hemp headlines and some great musical break brought to us by Cannabis Carry, just like always. So get ready to enjoy your Normal Daily Audio Stash. Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our Normal Daily Audio Stash, Hemp Headlines. Update on the dog shooting story. Police pattern of dog executions. An attorney came forward yesterday to allege a possible pattern of animal abuse by the Sheriff's Department in Prince George's County, Maryland. Michael Winkleman said he is representing another family whose dog was shot by sheriff's deputies in November, along with a woman who is suing the department for searching her home without a warrant and threatening to shoot her dog. In the first case, Winkleman said, sheriff's deputies arrived at the Accokeek home of Frank and Pamela Myers with a warrant for another house on their street. After the couple informed the deputies of the error, they continued to question the couple and looked around their home. As they spoke, the couple's 5-year-old German boxer began barking in a yard, out of sight. Soon after, according to Winkleman, the couple heard gunshots, and they found the dog shot to death. He said the family is preparing to file suit. In another case, Upper Marlboro resident Amber James has filed a $4 million lawsuit accusing sheriff's deputies of searching her home without a warrant in May 2007 while looking for her sister, who lived in Capitol Heights. According to the suit, deputies falsely claimed to have a warrant and searched every room of the home. When they did not find the sister, the suit alleges, they then threatened to return the next day and search again, saying that if they did, James's dog would be dead. Some lawyers and leading law enforcement groups said deputies should have known to do everything possible to avoid killing the dogs of Shai Calvo, the mayor of Berwyn Heights, Maryland, whose dogs were executed during a raid at their home by police. Courts across the country in recent years have ruled that it is almost always unacceptable for police to kill pets in the course of searching a home. Cases in 3 federal circuits have found that killing pets amounts to unreasonable seizure. Killing dogs is considered a last resort, said John Gagne, executive director of the National Tactical Officers Association, a group that provides tactical training for police departments and is advocating a national accreditation system for SWAT programs. Last resort, huh? Mm-hmm. Sure it is. I've been reading a lot of stories about this Shai Calvo case and reading a lot of the comments from people who are weighing in, and this one particular comment sums a lot of them up. Killing the dogs is standard operating procedure in SWAT raids. It is intended to terrorize the perps, to shock and awe them into absolute and immediate submission. The message here is, yeah, that's right, I killed your dog and there isn't a damn thing you can do about it. We have the authority and the power to do this, and if you don't shut the fuck up and do exactly as I say, then you're next. Any claims to the contrary are bullshit. Pineapple Express, the latest stoner hit, from CNN.com. Los Angeles, California. Stoners are riding high nowadays. Fans are buzzing about the reunion of Cheech and Chong after a long feud, and a couple of tokers are lighting up the box office with Pineapple Express. The movie casts Seth Rogen as a pot smoker hunted by drug lords and crooked cops after he witnesses a murder. He leaves a smoking gun, or rather a smoking roach, at the scene. A strain of pot called Pineapple Express that's so potent and rare, the bad guys can track it back to its source, Rogan's dealer, played by James Franco. So the duo ends up as an odd couple on the run. Rogan's pot hound is a fairly responsible guy with a day job as a process server, while Franco's peddler is so lovably fuzzy-headed from the weed that it's a wonder he can tell a nickel bag from a potted fern. Pineapple Express inhaled a healthy $40.5 million at the box office since opening Wednesday, no doubt securing Rogan and Franco a perpetual place among partiers' pantheon of Hollywood bong buddies. According to the website the-movie-times.com, which tracks box office receipts, Pineapple Express's $40 million has grossed more than Harold and Kumar Escape from Guantanamo Bay, which grossed about $38 million. Of course, the sales of DVDs and the international box office may push both of these movies closer to $100 million between them, especially considering Pineapple Express is still in wide release. Marijuana leaf ads on Olympia buses raise ire, from the Seattle Times. Olympia, Washington. Some riders and at least one driver are complaining about an advertisement featuring a marijuana leaf on some transit buses in Olympia. The Olympia Hempfest ad, accepted by Intercity Transit, has an image of a marijuana leaf and the slogan, "Equal rights are for everybody." A lawyer for the transit agency, Tom Bjorgen, says the ads could have been rejected if they were viewed as encouraging people to smoke pot. However, Bjorgen says a reasonable reader would more likely see the ads as a political statement for legalization of marijuana. Olympia Hempfest founder Jeremy Miller says Intercity Transit was paid about $3,000 to place the ads on the sides of 12 buses for 4 weeks. I'm surprised Miller was able to get the ads placed on the buses in the first place. Numerous drug reform organizations have tried many times in the past to get simple, reform-oriented ads in public places, but are constantly shot down with the old, "we don't want to encourage drug use" mantra. That's one of the difficulties in our battle. We want to educate the public that marijuana policy is harmful, and that's interpreted as a pro-drug message. Just see our previous story on the Rick Steves video. We can't talk about marijuana because it's illegal, and we can't change the legality of it because we're not allowed to talk about it.
Stupid Stoner Stories.
As a public service, Normal reminds you that smoking marijuana will not make one stupid. However, some stupid people do smoke marijuana. Don't be one of those stoners that make the rest of us look bad. Learn your lesson from today's
Stupid Stoner Story.
Lake Mary, Florida police stopped a motorcycle over the weekend because the driver was using the turn lane to pass other vehicles. After finding marijuana and a set of scales, the officer placed Jose Heriberto Torres under arrest. According to police reports, Torres, age 25, of Lake Mary, offered the officer $500 if he would just write him a ticket instead of taking him to jail. Torres faces charges of bribery, possessing marijuana and narcotic equipment, and operating a motorcycle without a license. He was released from Seminole County Jail on a $2,150 bond.
Normal Legal Committee attorney Jeffrey Steinborn says it best. If you're going to break the law, try to make it only one law at a time. If you're riding around with marijuana and scales, you ought to be the most law-abiding safe driver on the road. Cruise control is your friend, and your turn signal is your wingman. And for Pete's sake, you don't try to bribe an officer, especially in Florida, where the mere possession of over 20 grams is a felony. You have a right to remain silent and call an attorney. Use them.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
The National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws is the largest grassroots drug law reform organization in America. So every Monday we visit with the activists in drug law reform who are fighting for our freedom.
Freedom, the freedom. I'm coming to whatever I want.
Get motivated to get it regulated. Join us in some political activism today. You can start by visiting norml.org. We're all fighting for an end to adult marijuana prohibition, and one of the places this fight is taking a new level is in the state of Oregon, where activists with Oregon's for Cannabis Reform have joined together to produce the OCTA 2010. This is the Oregon Cannabis Tax Act for 2010. This is an initiative that would not decriminalize, since Oregon's already decriminalized. This is a form of taxation and regulation with marijuana to be purchased by the state and sold in liquor stores, which, according to a Zogby poll, we found that 55% of the people on the West Coast believe in some sort of tax and regulate scheme for cannabis. Now, joining us today is one of our board of directors members from Normal and the executive director of Oregon Normal and the co-chief petitioner of the OCTA 2010, Madeline Martinez, joins us by telephone. Madeline, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Russ. I'm happy to be here.
What leads me to the call today is the fact that you are starting to get a whole lot of media attention on this, specifically with the major newspaper, the major daily newspaper in Oregon, in Portland, the Oregonian, featuring you on the Sunday business section. Tell us a little bit about that interview.
Well, you know, it's wonderful to be taken seriously. And I'm always a little nervous when newspapers call for interviews, because we so often get these kind of hippy-dippy as they march through the fog of smoke and, you know, with their dreadlocks. And I want to be taken seriously because this is a serious effort. This is a way that I see as a grandmother to provide health care for everyone's grandchildren, for every Oregonian. And I think it's a more sensible way to control marijuana rather than thinking that somehow it's under control because of the marijuana task force in our state or any of these agencies that should really be focusing on violent crimes, in my opinion.
Yeah, it is quite amazing when you look at the national statistics from the FBI's Uniform Crime Report. We arrest more people for the mere possession of marijuana than we do for all violent crimes combined in this country.
And what kind of sense does that make? You know, it's obvious that this current policy on marijuana is ridiculous. It is the definition of insanity to continue to do the same act and expect a different outcome, and nothing is changing. And as I said, as a grandmother, I'd really like my grandchildren to be protected. If they choose when they're 21 to go to a store and buy marijuana, I'd like to see that money go to Oregon's general fund rather than to the black hole, which is the black market.
Yeah. Now, when you do this interview, when you went in to sit in for this interview, did you find them trying to push the interview toward a kind of a silly ho-ho look at the stoners kind of point of view?
Well, there was only once when the question was posed to me that which choice of marijuana humor did I find most, you know, comical, which was it Cheech and Chong or Harold and Kumar? And I said, actually, neither. This is a very serious issue for me. And, you know, sometimes you look at the stigma that some of these movies cause in our society where people think that it's just a big joke and all we do is sit around. And the biggest thing, as with some of the right-wing interviews that I've done, is, you know, people sitting around smoking in a hazy room with a bag of Doritos. Well, let me just tell you, I'm on the board, as you mentioned, of National Normal. I'm the executive director of Oregon Normal. And we have two meetings a month for cardholders. And, you know, I'm working the Octocan campaign. So there really isn't any time to sit around and eat Doritos. You know, it's not in my world anywhere. And I'm a hands-on grandmother. So, you know, it's just they already have this stereotype of us. And I think that, unfortunately, these kinds of comedies really make it seem real to people.
Yeah, that's unfortunate sometimes. Now, in the interview, they brought up a point about, you know, the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, which has been in effect for 10 years now. And they worry about this issue of impairment, that suddenly, you know, if we made marijuana legal and people could buy it in liquor stores, next thing you know, everybody's going to show up to work high. How do you respond to that?
Well, I respond in that no one should show up to work high on any form of medicine, any drug. My position is that we should have impairment testing. It's more sensible. It is more useful to our society to find out if people are impaired, and most people we find are impaired because they're so tired. Mm. You know, how is it safe for a person to come after a hangover to work? And, I mean, I've seen some people in my own life that have been so impaired just by a hangover and a lack of sleep that I wouldn't want them to work with me because that isn't a safe environment. So if we're going to test for drugs, let's test for all drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, one of the characterizations in the article kind of left me wanting. It was when they pointed out about the Oregon Cannabis Tax Act possibly making the ballot in 2010, they characterized it as a long shot, that there wouldn't be much chance of this passing. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't think that they're accurate in that. All of the polling that we've done, granted it's non-scientific polling, but it was on all of our local big stations, you know, the different affiliates, ABC, CBS, and even Fox. And all of our polling showed that people agree that they think it is time to tax and regulate marijuana, to be spending the amounts of money that we are in our society as a taxpayer alone, whether you're a consumer or not, this is ridiculous to be spending in Oregon $61.5 million processing people through court. No one should drive under the influence of anything, but to say that these people need to be locked up is outrageous, in my opinion.
From an activism point of view, why tackle the big kahuna of legalization at this time and not maybe focus on the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act that is by all measures a successful act, but it still has some problems, like the problem of not having a method for getting medicine to the patients? Why make the big leap now?
Well, because I think that after a decade of seeing that the medical marijuana program has caused a rise in crime or raping and pillaging in the streets of Oregon, I think that people can look at us and say, you know, this is working out pretty well. We have over 20,000 patients. We've contributed to the general fund over $900,000. And, you know, it's a lucrative program. It's all self-funded. And I really do believe that Oregon is progressive enough now. And as I said, by the non-scientific polling that we've seen, it's a great, I think, opportunity to fund our state's budget. Right now we're in a crisis. We're losing our federal timber monies. And Governor Kulongoski himself has asked for a solution. Well, here's the solution. Let's grow industrial hemp. And, you know, I think that our stewardship of our planet has just, you know, become not really, people say they're green and they really care, but how is raping our timber really working out? You know, it's not. It's not. Here in the great state of Oregon, it's a real sad picture when you cruise down the I-5 corridor and you see all these little patches of old growth that have been taken down. Let's plant industrial hemp. Let's get our farmers back to work. Rather than importing hemp from other countries and increasing their economies, let's increase the economy here, right in the state of Oregon.
Now, I'm glad you brought that up, because people hear about the Oregon Cannabis Tax Act, and the big splash on this is going to be, you know, selling marijuana in liquor stores. That's going to get a lot of hype and a lot of headlines. But people may not realize the Oregon Cannabis Tax Act also legalizes completely the growing of industrial hemp for our farmers. How we go about selling that to the more conservative areas of the state, the places where the farming would take place, do you find that they're going to be receptive to this kind of message?
Well, you know, I certainly hope that the farmers that are currently losing their land to the government because they're not growing any crops would open up and embrace, you know, our ideas, this concept of getting those farmlands back to work and making them once again productive members of our society. And here in Oregon, we have so much of that going on. We hear about this every day. And what we're going to do is we're going to go on a tour of the different granges throughout the state and give them the information. A lot of people just don't have the information. They think of hemp and they think of, as you said, marijuana. Uh-oh, we don't want anything to do with that. Well, this is different than marijuana. This is industrial hemp. It's food. It's fuel. It is paper, plastic. Anything that can be made out of wood can be made out of hemp.
Yeah, that would be a great alternative economy there for especially the southern counties in Oregon that were so dependent on that timber revenue.
Oh, exactly. And this is a great way to get us out of the horrible budgetary hole that we find ourselves in. And another thing that I always try to remind people of is that America's roots are hemp roots. You know, our country was founded, not just our founders, our founding fathers, actually many of them were hemp farmers, as you know, Russ. Mm-hmm. And I always wonder, well, people talk and talk about how brilliant these men were. You know, what about the fact that they were hemp farmers? And that's the basis of our country was founded on hemp.
Absolutely. Now let's get people some information about how they can help contribute to or volunteer for the Oregon Cannabis Tax Act. You got a website or a phone number they should know?
We certainly do. We have a website which is octa2010.org, and that'll take you right to our main website, which is Cannabis Tax Act, because of course we hope to spread the word around the nation, because once we feel that once Oregon gets on the ballot and passes this, then all the other states will follow. So that's where they can go. And they can, you know, send anything they want, money, of course, to or OCTA at P.O. Box 16057, Portland, Oregon 97292. Or they can give us a call at 888-OCT-2010.
Do it again. It's 888-OCTA-2010. It's got an A in it.
888-OCTA-2010.
All right. So that's great information to get out there. We encourage everyone to take a look at this and maybe even take a look at the language of this act and think about introducing it in your state. There's no reason Oregon has to be the only one that tries this. We could get this started in lots of places, I would think.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, the federal government is going to enjoin that. That's the same thing, Russ, that people said about the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. Well, the feds are going to come in and they're going to enjoin this. One thing I always want to encourage people and remind them that whenever there's money to be made, you can be sure that Uncle Sam's looking at it. And, you know, not just illegally, this would be right on top of the table.
Yeah, that'd be the way to do it, absolutely.
Yes, and we've got some treaties in there that will set us up for federal litigation, so.
Excellent. Well, Madeline Martinez is the co-chief petitioner of the OCTA 2010, the Oregon Cannabis Tax Act. They're gathering signatures right now, so check out OCTA2010.org so you can get more information on that. Madeline's also the on the board of directors for Normal and the executive director of Oregon Normal.
And I'd like to encourage people to go and read the article. It's at Oregonian.com.
All right, Oregonian.com. Madeline, thanks for joining us again here on the Daily Audio Stash.
Thanks, Russ.
76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NOLM. My name is Keith Stropp, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at Normal, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org. Mondays don't seem so blue when we add some great blues music to the soundtrack. Today's Blue Monday song comes from an artist named Davis Cohen. Some tasty guitar licks and a mouthful of delicious blues can nourish the Monday blahs with today's track, Some Strange Feeling. Davis calls Charleston, South Carolina home and has toured in the U.S. with such blues greats as James Cotton, North Mississippi All-Stars, and John Mayall and the Blues Breakers. Davis has some of his instrumental music included on the DVD release of Martin Scorsese's PBS special, The Blues. You can sample and buy his CDs on his website, www.daviscohen.com, that's DAVISCOEN.com, or his MySpace page. You can find the links to both of those at our website, stash.normal.org, where you'll also find an MP3 download of this tune. It's Davis Cohen with Some Strange Feeling.
been coming over me today. Some strange feeling been coming over me today. Thinking about you, baby. You ever find some place to stay? You got that sweet summer. Something you don't want to lose. You got that sweet something, baby. Something you don't want to lose. And you got me, baby. You know I'm somebody you don't want to abuse. Hey, hey. Hey, hey. Hey, child. Hey, hey, hey. Abuse me, baby. When I first met you, I knew I needed a taste. When I met you, baby, I knew I needed a taste. Now that I got you, baby, I know I ain't got no time to wait. Hey, hey. You didn't have no regret. I gave you the blues so hard. You know you didn't have no regret. You are the best man in this world. Woman like you ever get. Hey, hey, hey.
The National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, known as NORML, has worked for over 30 years to change the misguided cannabis prohibition that has been a scourge to the public health and safety of our nation. NORML's efforts are highlighted by frequent legal and legislative success, creating the growing dialogue with elected officials and law enforcement. For more information about marijuana and to find out what you can do to help end prohibition, contact the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws at NORML.org or toll free at 888-67-NORML.
We've been following a really tragic case in Tallahassee, Florida, the case of Rachel Hoffman. You may have caught it on ABC News' 2020. Just as a brief recap, Rachel Hoffman was a 23-year-old woman, college student, recent college graduate in Florida, who was a minor marijuana user and sold a bit to her friends. Police arrested her and used her as bait in a drug sting that went horribly wrong, and she ended up losing her life. And so there's some new updates, and joining us here to talk about that is NORML's Deputy Director, Paul Armentano. Paul, welcome back to the Stash.
Thanks for having me, Russ.
Well, I guess the biggest update we need to get to is the grand jury coming back with their review of this case. Let our listeners know what the grand jury had to say about this.
Well, yeah, you're right. In arguably the biggest news to come out of this case in the last couple days, a 15-member grand jury did come back on Friday, and they found five members of the Tallahassee Police Department, one investigator and four supervisors, to have been negligent in contributing to the death of Rachel Hoffman. They found them negligent in their signing off on this dubious sting operation, and they were also negligent in their failure to properly monitor Rachel as she underwent this sting operation.
Yeah, even one of the grand jurors went and wrote some pretty telling text here about how they felt about this case. They say less than 15 minutes after she drove away from the offices of the Tallahassee Police Department, she drove out of sight of the officers who assured her they would be right on top of her watching and listening the whole time. She cried out for help as she was shot and killed, and nobody was there to hear her. Is this type of editorializing something you would typically find in a grand jury report?
You know, the grand jury is clearly here trying to make a statement. And just to for the edification of the listeners, you know, grand juries are convened all the time. I believe in this case, the state prosecutor, who really does deserve a lot of credit in this case, William Meigs, has really been taking on the TPD on this issue. And I believe that because there was a death of an informant, automatically a grand jury would be convened. But there's no legal weight to these findings. There is a lot of moral weight, and I really do think because of the scathing language that was used by this jury, they were really trying to send a message to the public and to the TPD that they were gravely in error. And certainly one would think that if the parents of Rachel Hoffman do decide at some point down the road to file some sort of wrongful death claim, for instance, against the Tallahassee Police Department, the findings of this grand jury would certainly bolster their case.
Yeah, I would think so. And this prosecutor, Willie Meigs, out there in Florida, he's been reacting pretty strongly to the DEA. We had an update on that as well, where he was refusing to prosecute DEA-involved cases. Is that correct?
Yes. You know, this is really a strange twist. You know, after the grand jury on Friday came back with these findings, the TPD did suspend with pay, I might add, five of the officers that were found to be negligent. I want to highlight, actually, or one of the supervisors, this Lieutenant White, who the grand jury of the five, they came down on her the hardest, and certainly with good reason. This was the supervisor who actually signed off on the operation plan, this idea that Rachel would go and meet these two individuals and make this outrageous buy of a handgun and 1,500 ecstasy pills and 2 ounces of crack cocaine. She admitted to the grand jury that even though she approved this operation plan, she had actually never read it. So essentially, she just simply rubber-stamped this plan and didn't know what it was. She also was the supervisor on duty that night that was supposed to be closely monitoring Rachel's audio transmissions, because Rachel Hoffman was, in fact, wearing a wire when she went to meet these two Tallahassee drug dealers. But once again, under oath, Supervisor White admitted to the grand jury that, in fact, she was distracted that night because she was also performing an audit, and she really wasn't closely listening to the transmissions that Rachel was sending back to the police department. So here, and I should also mention that this is actually the fifth time since 1999 Lieutenant White has been under investigation by Internal Affairs for improper conduct. I would also mention she's only been in vice for 3 months prior to signing off on this operation. So while there's certainly blame to go around in this case to a whole number of people, the grand jury, I do think, very properly identified this supervisor in particular as arguably being the most negligent in costing Rachel Hoffman her life. Regarding what you said about the DEA, I should note that rather than apologizing for his department's abhorrent performance in this case, Police Chief Jones, following the grand jury's findings, rather than apologize, has really tried to go on the offensive. And the way he has done that is to claim that, in fact, Rachel was a very high-profile drug dealer who was under investigation by the DEA and, in fact, was selling up to $2 million worth of marijuana a year out of her one-bedroom home. Now, this is a very interesting accusation to have, you know, made after the fact by the police chief, because they never made these sort of claims prior to last Friday, prior to the grand jury coming back. And in fact, there doesn't seem to be any hard evidence that Rachel Hoffman was any more than a small-time marijuana user in a college town who sometimes shared marijuana with her friends. But after these accusations were made, State Prosecutor Willie Meggs said, well then, I want to hear from the DEA. You say they were investigating her. I want the DEA here. I want them to talk before the grand jury. I want them to tell the grand jury what you claim they know. Not surprisingly, the DEA did not come to testify before the grand jury. And as a result, the state attorney's office in Florida says that he will not work with the DEA in any future cases.
Wow, it's really rare to see these different echelons of law enforcement and prosecution kind of fighting against each other in a case like this, isn't it?
Yes, it's very rare, and it's very rare to see a state prosecutor stand up and basically go after one of their own. But clearly, Willie Meggs is doing it in this case, arguably because the conduct was so egregious on the part of the Tallahassee Police Department that if, you know, Police Chief Jones is looking for some sort of life raft be seized from the state attorney's office, you know, he's not going to get it from Willie Meggs.
Yeah, and the other thing that just doesn't pass the smell test here for me, you know, first of all, the idea that, oh, she was selling 10 to 15 pounds of marijuana a week, so that means she deserved to die? I mean, the amount to me sounds, you know, wouldn't really matter what amount she was dealing. She didn't deserve to die. But this idea that, you know, that she was selling $35,000 a week is what they're trying to say here, as what she was selling. And when they busted her house, they only found 5 ounces of pot and a ledger where she recorded her sales. Wouldn't they just look at the ledger? I mean, isn't that the evidence that would say how much she was dealing?
Well, Russ, it's even more absurd than that. You know, this was a girl who, you know, her father was paying most of her expenses. Her father was paying her auto insurance. Her father was paying the rent on her car. Her father was paying her cell phone bill. And while, you know, there might be some people that can argue whether, you know, a girl's father at age 23 should still be covering these sort of expenses, that aside, the bottom line is, you know, if this woman was making just $1.8 million a year, allegedly from selling pot, where's the money?
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be any secret bank account. And in fact, there are records that her family was the one who paid her bills because Rachel Hoffman typically did not have a lot of money to her name. The other, notion that's just absurd about this whole idea, and as I said, these claims that suddenly Rachel Hoffman was one of the biggest drug dealers in Tallahassee have all come after the fact, and specifically they've come after the grand jury found the Tallahassee Police Department negligible in her death. Think about this. If the police came in and busted this girl, who, as they noted earlier, did have a prior marijuana possession offense, was in fact enrolled in drug court, if the police came into her home with evidence that she was selling $35,000 a week of marijuana from her home, do you think they would have simply cut a deal with her and
yeah,
not filed any charges? I mean, it's absurd to think that the Tallahassee Police Department would have found evidence indicating that Rachel Hoffman was a high-profile drug dealer and not even have arrested her for these charges, but instead would have cut a deal with her to have her turn into a confidential informant. And there again, if they really did believe that Rachel Hoffman was connected to individuals pushing very large quantities of marijuana, why, as a confidential informant, did the Tallahassee Police Department not ask Rachel to turn in her supplier?
Yeah, why turn to the other two?
Know, instead, the testimony says that, in fact, the TPD initially asked Rachel to simply give them the names of some of her small-time friends that she shared marijuana with. And when she refused to do that, Then they began going on a fishing expedition to try and see, you know, what drug dealers in town they could set up Rachel to make a buy from. And when they did select the two individuals that killed her, these were two individuals that Rachel didn't even know. She didn't have a prior relationship with them. Once again, it is unfathomable to think that the Tallahassee Police Department would have behaved this way if they legitimately had evidence that Rachel was a major drug dealer and, in fact, had a supplier up the chain. That's who they would have gone after if they would have used her as a confidential informant. But either the way, they certainly still would have arrested her and booked her before trying to cut any deal.
Yeah, the story gets worse and worse the more the details that come out about it. And I think the thing that probably upsets me the most about it is them being suspended with pay. It's like a nice little vacation.
Yeah, and, you know, having followed these sort of stories for some time, you know, you get jaded. And, you know, any time I hear that the police officer will be investigated by internal affairs, or any time you hear that a police department is performing their own internal investigation, you know, you kind of roll your eyes, because what generally happens is while the investigation's pending, the officers in question get a nice little paid vacation, and then, you know, a few months later, internal affairs comes back and they find that, in fact, the officers didn't do anything wrong and they go back to their job. You see this over and over again. Fortunately, in this case, I think there may be some slightly different outcomes simply because of how much publicity it's garnered and because of the fact that Rachel's parents, to their credit, have taken their case to the state legislature. There was a bill filed, last week, a claims bill in the Florida legislature that seeks to financially compensate the parents of Rachel Hoffman due to the negligence of the Tallahassee Police Department. There's also a bill that Rachel's father is arguing in favor of that would change the way police in Florida do business with confidential informants. For instance, one change that this proposal would make would be that no suspect could begin working undercover for the police without first having met with legal counsel and discussed this sort of deal with legal counsel. In the case of Rachel Hoffman, one of many abhorrent facts in this case is that when the Tallahassee Police Department asked Rachel to become an informant, they instructed her specifically that she was not to discuss this deal with anyone, including her own attorney. And of course they argued for that because I'm sure the Tallahassee Police Department were aware that had Rachel discussed this with her attorney would have said it's a terrible idea and don't do it. So in fact, this bill, this so-called Rachel's Law, before the legislature, would make certain changes so that other people's sons and daughters can't be used as cannon fodder for the police department when they try to engage in these war on drugs sting operations.
We'll keep an eye out on this story and keep everyone updated as it goes along. You can check out the Stash blog at stash.normal.org/tag/Rachel-Hoffman. You'll catch all the stories that we've done since this story first broke. And Paul, I understand you've got an article coming out on this. Where can people find that?
Well, I've been doing quite a bit of writing on this case. If they go to alternate.org and in the search box either type my name or type in the name Rachel Hoffman, they'll see about a 700-word piece I had on this about a couple weeks ago. And just today I was turning in copy for a 2,500-word feature story on this case and the latest developments in it that's slated to appear in Cannabis Culture. People also want to check out a very good political publication known as the Cold Type Reader, which I believe is at coldtype.net. They can also download an article that I have on this case as well.
All right. Paul Armentano is the deputy director of Normal and doing yeoman's work here tracking the case of Rachel Hoffman. Paul, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Russ.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with another one of our cannabis quotes, this one from Eldridge Cleaver, the famed civil rights leader of the 1960s, who said, quote, "The characteristics of the white rebels, which most alarm their elders, the long hair, the new dances, their love of Negro music, their use of marijuana, their mystical attitudes towards sex, are also tools of their rebellion. They have turned these tools against the totalitarian fabric of American society, and they mean to change it." End quote. Well, some of the people who grew up in the 60s and 70s are still trying to change it, but a whole lot of them seem to have copped out and agreed with the criminalization of marijuana, or at least not tried too hard to change it. Maybe this next generation, the generation of the millennials, the generation that has been raised under the domain of legal medical marijuana for the past 12 years in some U.S. states, maybe this will be the generation to finally make the change. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us here for the Daily Audio Stash. We'll be back tomorrow with more news and information you can use for the cannabis community. And until then, take care of each other, tokers.